भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Hopefully this thing works. This is Canto 10, Chapter 84, text number 14. I will read through the English on 14 up to 17, and on 17 we will do the Sanskrit as we normally do. But I will to conserve time and to get more information about the verse itself, I'll go straight to the English, starting from number 14. Shukdeva Goswami said, hearing such unfathomable words from the unlimitedly wise Lord Krishna, the learned Brahmins remained silent, their minds bewildered. Text 15. For some time the sages pondered the Supreme Lord's behavior, which resembled that of a subordinate living being. They concluded that he was acting this way to instruct the people in general. Thus they smiled and spoke to him, the spiritual master of the universe. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains, the word ishtavyata is referring to one's not being a controller, or in other words, to being under the law of karma. Karma, obliged to work and experience the result of one's work. While addressing the sages, Lord Krishna accepted the role of a subordinate living being to emphasize the importance of hearing and serving saintly Vaishnavas. The personality of Godhead is also the supreme teacher of spiritual surrender. So he's obviously showing everyone else how to surrender. Text number 16. Translation. The great sages said, your power of illusion has totally bewildered us. The most exalted knowers of the truth and leaders among the universal creators. Ah, how amazing is the behavior of the Supreme Lord. He covers himself with his human-like activities and pretends to be subject to superior control. Purport. The sages have characterized the Lord's statement as inscrutable. Duryanvayam. How this is so is stated here. His words and activities bewilder even the most learned when he plays at subordinating himself to his own servants. Now, in Los Angeles, we usually read each of the Sanskrit words. Is that done here? And then go through the verse itself? Okay. I'll just go through the verse. Sorry, I'll go right into it.
Aniha etan bahudaika atmana.
Sorry. Do the verse again, that line again.
Aniha etan bahu daika atmanam.
Aniha etan bahu daika atmanam.
Srijatya vatyati na vajyate yata.
Srijatya vatyati na vajyate
yata. Vaimar hi bhumir bahu namarupini.
Vaimar hi bhumir bahu namarupini.
Aho vibhu manash. Charitam vidambanam. Aniha etan bahu daika atmana.
Aniha etan bahu daika
atmana. Sujatya vatyati na vajyat te yata.
Sujatya vatyati na vajyat te yata.
Umarhi bumir bahu nama Rupini. Aho vimu manash charitam vidambanam. Aniha etan bahu dika atmana.
Aniha etan bahu dika atmana.
Srijatya vatyati na vajyate yataha. Vamar hi bhumir bahu nama rupini. Aho vibhu manash charitam vidambanam. Please chant.
Anyone else like to try? Any ladies? Students? No? Vaishnavis? No? Nobody wants to take? We don't kick you out if you do it wrong. You still stay here.
Huh?
Any other Vaishnavis? Students?
Thank you.
Translation. Indeed, the human-like pastimes of the Almighty are simply a pretense. Effortlessly, he alone sends forth from his self this variegated creation, maintains it, and then swallows it up again, all without becoming entangled, just as the element earth takes on many names and forms in its various transformations. Purport. Oh, before, why don't we do this together? Please repeat. Indeed. The human-like pastimes of the Almighty are simply a pretense. Effortlessly, he alone sends forth from his self this variegated creation, maintains it, and then swallows it up again, all without becoming entangled. Just as the element earth takes on many names and forms in its various transformations. Purport. The One Supreme expands himself as many without diminishing his completeness. He does this effortlessly, without depending on anyone or anything else. This mystic process of the Lord's self-expansion is incomprehensible to all but himself. But the example of the substance earth and its manifold products bears enough resemblance to provide some idea. The same example is also presented in an often cited passage of the Chandogya Upanishad 6.1, Vacharam banam vikaro namadenyam mitiket yeva satyam, which means, quote, earth's transformations are merely verbal creations of the process of naming the substance earth itself is alone real. Srila Sridhar Swami suggests that this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam answers a possible objection on the part of Lord Krishna. Quote, how can I create, maintain, and destroy the universe if I am Vasudeva's son? The answer is given by the words, Aho Vibhumanash Charitam Vidambanam, which means, you are the perfectly complete whole, and your birth and pastimes are only an imitation of ordinary persons' activities in the material world. You simply pretend to be under higher control. Omajyanati mirandasya gananjana shilakaya chakshu tamyena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Aniha etad bahudaika atmana shrijat yavat yati na badyate yata balmerhi bhumir bahunama rupuni aho vibhumanash charitam vidambanam. Again, indeed, the human-like pastimes of the Almighty are simply a pretense. Effortlessly, he alone sends forth from his self this variegated creation, maintains it, and then swallows it up again, all without becoming entangled. Just as the element earth takes on many forms, many names in its various transformations. Amadhyanati mirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshurum maritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. Again, thank you all for coming. Anybody here, who made this garland? Well, whoever you are, thank you very much. It was very kind of you to make it. It's very colorfully put together. and it's greatly appreciated by myself. Thank you. Huh? Yeah, but somebody made it, though. Yeah, so that's... I didn't think Prabhupada was making it, at least not these days. Probably in the spiritual world for Krishna. Yes. So, we have a very interesting situation here, which it bears a bit of commenting. This is all taking place... All right, I'll ask the question. This is all taking place at where? Come on, raise your hand. Where is this happening? Okay, it's happening at Kurukshetra. On the occasion of what? Come on, get your thinking caps on, guys. You got a hand up? Let's hear it. On the occasion of what? Okay, it's a solar eclipse. Does everybody know what a solar eclipse is? You do? Okay, who... Raise your hand if you know. Okay, in just a few... You know what a solar eclipse is? Okay, in just a few words, what gets in front of what? The moon gets in front of what? The sun. And creates, and between the sun and the earth, and creates a dark, dark shadow so that it gets very dark. Okay. So I just want to be sure everybody knows what a solar eclipse is, because it happened to be an occasion in which the Yadu dynasty, Kuru dynasties, and a number of other very noble and famous dynasties came. So we can't have any talking going on during the time, because it distracts me, and then I can't say what I really want to say. So can we all keep it quiet? And keep it down to a whisper if you must speak. I realize sometimes it's necessary for different things. So what has happened is Krishna is there with his family, with the Yadu dynasty, Yadus. And he's manifesting himself pretty much like, he's not an ordinary person, the obvious. He's a super ordinary person, but he's playing the part of an ordinary, super ordinary person. That might sound conflicting, but it's not. You can't help but when you see Krishna that you feel some reverence, some greatness, some awe. He's there, but yet he's pretending to be like everybody else. He's talking with people. He's joking with his friends. He's greeting people. He's asking people how they are, welcoming them. And then suddenly a tremendous congregation of great, great sages enters the area, and everything stops. And as the sages come forth, Krishna immediately gives the signal, and all of these sages are greeted in a proper way. And again, Krishna shows us how to greet persons who are of a highly saintly nature. And now, there's a tremendous lineup of, it's not just a few sages, but it's a whole congregation of them, such as Vyasadeva is there, Narada Muni is there, Dandala is there, Bhardwaj is there, Parashuram is there, and his disciples are there. I mean, that's quite a lineup to be in the company, to be in the environment of so many auspicious personalities. And Krishna mentions that while one may go to the Ganges and take its waters and be blessed by the Ganges, because these are the drops of water coming from Lord Krishna's feet. One may go to a pilgrimage space, place, and take the benefit of the vibrations. He said that in comparison to being amongst such a collection of great souls and the impact that they have upon human beings is so rapid that it can cause persons to even immediately begin to wonder, what am I doing here? What's the purpose of my life? Why am I here? What is my destiny? What should I be doing? You see, only a great sage can induce such types of questions. This is what Srila Prabhupada did for us. His personality, his affection, his love, his gratitude, his kindness, his sweetness, all of these qualities immediately brought out from us This is an amazing, this is a wonderful, this is a glorious person. Someone whom I've never met before. Someone whose likeness I'd never met before. Consequently, we wanted to know more and more and more. So, and what did we want to know? We wanted to know what he came to bring. And what he came to bring is the message of Godhead. Why we're here and how to go back home, back to Godhead. So these sages, as Krishna mentions very clearly, these sages had the power to induce that type of a mentality so that we, in other words, it really expedites one's devotional activities, devotional service. It expedites and one's advancement. Because they are bringing forth their vibrations of love and devotion, dedication and surrender, and God realization. It's a vibration. And each and every one of them is manifesting that vibration, that aura. So when we come into that vibration, it's like coming into a whole environment of purity, of perfection, that which we normally would not encounter. It's very much like, for example, if you have some muddy water, like a bottle of muddy water, and then you suddenly take some clean, pure water and you start to pour it into the muddy water and you keep pouring. So what happens is gradually the mud water is replaced by the clean, pure water. Everybody understand that? Good. So eventually all you have is pure water. So that's what the sages do. Their vibration, their aura, their potency of love of God interpenetrates our aura and gradually transforms it into a higher level, causing us to automatically want to know, to want to strive, to want to achieve those things which are spiritual. That's what they do, and that is the value of a holy person. Let me tell a little story about that. Before I do, I just want to comment just briefly. When this great congregation of holy men enter, the first thing that's done is they're given a seat. No holy man is left standing. They're given a seat. They're given water. Their feet are washed, you know, because they've been walking. A lot of them walk barefoot through the dust and the dirt. Their feet are washed. And those who are smart, they take the water and they pour it all over their head and their face and their bodies because they want that vibration to interpenetrate their own body to facilitate and expedite their own spiritual advancement. So then they are given water to drink, and often they're given this achaman, different type of a preparation of rice and milk and so forth. Then they are often prayed to, glorified, and honored for their great achievements. They're made to feel what they are, truly great, venerable, honorable persons. So they accepted this. This is normal for them. They're always being glorified. But in the presence of the Supreme Lord Krishna, this was a little bit bewildering to them. And that's because Krishna is over there acting like just another general, friendly, convivial, nicely spoken, but not acting, you know, like the great mystic, you know, the master of all mystics, not putting on any kind of a show, rather blinding everyone with his yoga maya that he's just another person, which is the way he wants, because he wants a relationship to go on with all of the different persons. That's just called his rasa. And he enjoys this rasa because it gives him a lot of pleasure, especially with those persons who are acting towards him or acting on him, his father Vasudeva and Devaki and his friends. He wants them to think of them as just a friend. And he likes interacting with them in that manner. There are times when he may want them to revere him and glorify him and honor him, but not at this time. So the sages are sitting here. There is the person whom we worship, whom we honor, whom we glorify, whom we bow down to, whom we say prayers all day to, whom we chant mantras to, and there he's just standing around and glorifying us. What's the meaning of this? They're bewildered. The word he's used is they're bewildered. Rather, here they feel it should be the opposite. They came there to glorify Krishna, to take his darshan, Balarams too, and to bow down to them, to take the dust of their feet, knowing how great, how glorious, how wonderful they were. So that's why it's mentioned here in the verses that they were initially, they're a bit bewildered. They're a bit stunned. They weren't ready for this. So Krishna is showing, he's showing us how much he enjoys coming down to appearing to be like an ordinary person. He gets pleasure out of the interactions of the various rasas that he has with people. For example, the cowherd girls, they're looking at him with romance in their eyes, and the cowherd boys look at him with friendship in their eyes, and the elder Nanda Maharaj, Yashoda, they look at him as their son. And so he doesn't want to disturb that rasa, because that's the way in which their love continues to build and to grow and to develop and to get higher and stronger and more attached. And he likes that because it's pure love. It's not materialistic. That's, they have earned this position to be a mother and a father of Krishna. It's not like it was a random choice at all. It was a developed choice in which persons earn the right to be this, and they put in a lot of thousands and thousands of years of austerity. I mean, look at Vasudev and Devaki. Would you go back if, some lifetimes? They spent in a different bodily form. They spent thousands of years in the forest, subjecting themselves to the rain and the cold and many other hardships, living on leaves, dry leaves, berries. For what reason? When God appeared before them, he said, "What do you want?" He said, "We want you as our son." So he decided he would be their son for three different incarnations. Anyway, the important point is that this was a very honorable position. So the point is that Krishna has everything. He's always blissful. He's always peaceful. He's always joyful. He's always full of love. He doesn't need to go anywhere to feel happy. He's always happy. And yet, despite that fact, his happiness can be increased, it can be stimulated, it can be lifted up even higher, very much like an ocean wave. I mean, oceans have mild waves, but then when the winds come, strong winds, the waves get higher, like a 5-foot wave, a 10-foot wave, a 20-foot wave, we even have 50 and 100-feet waves when in these big howling cyclones. So similarly, when the devotees manifest pure love to Krishna in the form of devotional service. Let me just define love so I can move on to this, because love can mean many things to many people. Love, as it is being described in our books and it is meant, pure love means two things. It means to relieve someone of some suffering, or it means to give some gifts or some presents to the beloved, to make that person happy. You love your child, so you give them food, you give them clothing, you give them shelter, you teach them nursery rhymes, you teach them things that they can do that will make them happy. When they're good boys and good girls, you give them ice cream. So you see that the kids become happy, it makes the mother and the father happy. Look, he's smiling, that's good. So this is an expression, a simple expression of love. And then when the child becomes ill, gets a cold, or comes down, falls, hurts his knee or his shoulder, or maybe gets a fever, first thing, call the doctor, try to take the fever down if possible, try to bring the health back under control so that the child who is moaning and crying and saying, "I don't feel well, I feel so hot, or I got the chills." So mother, father want to do the very best for their child, and this is love. And it's quite natural and instinctive amongst parents because the child has come from your own body. So Krishna, All of us as souls have come basically from Krishna. He manifested all of us, and we're all his children. And when we realize ourselves as souls, then we realize that we all are brothers and sisters. It's like a ray of light from the sunshine. Millions of rays of light. Each one of us, a soul, is like a ray of light. You don't do that, please. Thank you. Is it because it distracts me? Each one of us is like a ray of light. But unfortunately, in the material world, we have forgotten that we have a source, and that is the sun globe. Actually, all we see are the other rays, and we think they're different from me, I'm different from them, and so forth. We're all different from one another. And in the material world, the business, of course, is to try to be a lord, to try to be a master, to try to be a powerhouse, to try to be great, to try to be tremendous, to be glorified, to be honored. So people are always competing against one another, trying to outdo one another, and consequently there is no peace of mind in the material world. Material education is such how to make you materially great while materially miserable. It's a great combination. I was mentioning to one of my classes, some of you may not know this because maybe you do. One of our previous Olympics champions, his name was Michael Phelps. He won 8 gold medals for winning the swimming meets, you know, breaststroke and backstroke and butterfly and all these type of things. So 8 gold medals. Nobody had ever until then won that. He was considered the greatest swimmer in the world. That's a great accolade to have. And not only that, but as a result of that achievement, he was given so many opportunities and offers from various major companies, swimsuit companies, to endorse them. Goggles, endorse them. Endorse them for what? Because people will buy them because Michael Phelps wears these goggles. Michael Phelps wears these swim trunks. Michael Phelps wears this nose thing. I don't know what they call it, but Michael Phelps, he has earplugs, the Phelps earplugs. I mean, millions and millions of dollars offered to him as a result of his winning those 8 gold medals. But was he happy? That was the real question. And the real answer is he was miserable. And how do we know this? Because we find out that in spite of the fact that he won all of these, and according to Western education, he should be the happiest man alive because he's the best of the best of the best in all the world, and yet he's miserable. That's not just a statement that I'm just pulling out of the Bhagavatam, that if you are successful, you necessarily have to be miserable. That's not the case. The Pandavas were successful, but they were not miserable because they knew the perfect philosophy of life. But this Michael Phelps knew no philosophy, except he wanted to be God. He wanted to be glorious. He wanted everyone thinking of himself. He wanted to be known as the most famous. And so when your consciousness is nothing more than me, I, mine, the net result is you distance yourself more and more and more from Krishna, you see. And when we distance ourselves more and more from Krishna, the vibrations of Krishna's love literally are withheld. And what is the result of that withholding? You feel empty. You feel depressed. You feel shallow. You feel something is missing. You don't feel cheerful. You don't feel joyful. You don't feel uplifted. You feel depressed. And what do you do when you feel depressed in the material world? They take to alcohol. That's one of the ways. And that's what he did. He became an alcoholic. Yes, an 8 gold medalist became an alcoholic. Think about it. He's supposed to be happy, but he's miserable. But when you take alcohol, it makes you giddy. Some of you kids, I don't think you've been to alcohol. Unless they're spiking your hot milk in the evening. There's no need for that. You kids look happy and ready to run and jump and chant Hare Krishna. But anyway, here he is drinking, and not only drinking, but irresponsibly. driving under the influence, getting into a car accident, and then having to go to this rehab. This is a good thing to go to the rehab, but they don't have real answers. They don't give them real answers because they don't know the real answers. The answer that they have, you know, they'll give you some, take this pill, take this chemical thing, and it will reduce this particular problem, give you a new problem. That usually comes, you know, 3 months later, they don't even connect the dots. So my point of all this is that not only did it take depression, but there was a picture in, I think it was Life magazine or Time magazine, of him smoking a marijuana pipe. This is our all-American hero. Can we believe this? And so my point is that happiness does not mean if you're wealthy, beautiful, wealthy, powerful, strong, influential, famous, knowledgeable, materially, those are no guarantees of happiness. The only guarantee there are is probably of misery. So anybody who likes to be really miserable, and if you don't have a transcendental or spiritual philosophy, then go to it. And many youngsters today in the universities and even in the high schools have been known to commit suicide because they don't have any zest or desire to go on living. They're being separated, disconnected from Krishna. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, one who is not connected with me in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? So this is the whole point. As we chant Hare Krishna, as we venerate the, glorify the deities, as we offer prayers to the deities, as we honor the spiritual master, I was told that this is part of the program, that they're not walking out on me. But I'm prepared for that also. So if I'm left with even one devotee who's ready to listen and not go to sleep, I'll keep going. That's pretty much my style. So anyway, getting back to the main point, which I'll come to in this moment, is that happiness, as Srila Prabhupada keeps mentioning over and over throughout his books, that happiness, real happiness, happiness is the connection of the, or the relationship, or the yoga, the joining of the soul with the super soul, and that joining is a joining of love, a joining of devotion, a joining of complete surrender, a joining of submission. The devotee wants so much to just serve and serve with love and serve with glorification and serve knowing this is the greatest, the best, the highest. There is no better service or job than this that exists. And this is what Srila Prabhupada instilled in us. This is the greatest. There's nothing higher, nothing better. Unfortunately, some devotees, they did not really grasp the message. And they went back into the material world thinking that to become a lord is a better thing and to experience the miseries of material life. It's very and most unfortunate when you've been given gold, and you throw it away to go and get lead. Any jeweler would know that you're absolutely crazy. So, anyway, that's my point. The point is that the association of these great souls made such a tremendous impact, and Krishna was glorifying them, honoring them, exalting them, telling everyone. His first statement is, "Now we are successful." That was his first statement, because the great sages have come, and I've already named them. So what does it mean? I talked about their vibration and their ability to impact, their ability to transform, their ability to motivate, just by their presence. Let us go to that very wonderful story. How many of you know the story of Magari the hunter? You all know that? Okay, well, I'll tell it again, because it's worth... Here we have a very good example. Narada Muni is wandering through the forest, and he's passing various animals on the ground in a half-living, half-dead state. And he's wondering, who's doing this? Then, I mean, it's one thing to kill the animal, take it home, and they, you know, these hunters, they'll eat it, or they'll use the skins, whatever. But the hunter is leaving the animal, deer, and squirrels, and different other animals, the pigs, boars. So he moves and walks on, and he sees the hunter, Magari. He's got his bow and arrow, and he's laughing. He's laughing at the torment of these animals. So Narada Muni approaches him, and he says, do you know what you're doing? And you know, when he looks at them, his eyes are just penetrating. And he immediately stopped. Now, Magari the hunter, he's not afraid. He'll go after lions and tigers. He's fearless. But in the face of Narada Muni, he just stopped. He says, you have no idea of the misery that you are creating for yourself in the future. He says, misery? What misery? He says, the misery. Do you see these half... First of all, why are you half-killing them? Why aren't you just completely killing them the way most hunters? He says, well, that's what my father taught me. He says, your father taught you that? Yes, so I just do what my father taught me. He said, you get happiness out of that? Yes, that is my happiness. Makes me happy. He says, well, let me tell you something. In your next life, you will be born as that half-killed squirrel. And in the next life, you will be also born as a boar, and you will be half killed. You see how they're squirming? You see how they're moaning? You see how they're grieving? And he looked closely. He said, what is so funny about that? What if I tore off from your entrails, and then you had to experience and bear that? You think that would be funny? You think that would be pleasurable? So immediately, transformation is taking place. The sensitivity of Narada Muni is registering upon the heart of Magari the hunter. He said, well, what can I do? This is what I learned. This is how I make my living. This is how I eat. He says, you follow what I tell you to do. Said, what should I do? He says, you and your wife, you move to the side of the river over there, and you make yourself a little bungalow, and you will live there, and you will chant this mantra. Didn't give what mantra, but I would just surmise that it was something like Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. At least that's the mantra he gave Dhruva Maharaj. So you just chant that mantra. He says, how will I eat? He says, don't you worry. The good Lord will take care of you. You sure? Yes, I'm sure. So he did that. He followed that. He went there, and when he had the little hut made, and he sat down, he started chanting the mantra. People started coming with bags of food, bags of rice, and bags of wheat, and bags of this, bags of that, and fruits and vegetables. He was amazed. He didn't have to do anything except chant the mantra, and God was delivering. The sage was following up, or the sage was fulfilling his word. So this went on for a certain period of time. I mean, if most all your life you've been working and killing animals in order to eat, and now you're just sitting there and chanting mantras. Anyway, the process of purification went on for several years. So Narada Muni's friend, Parvat Muni, they were talking. He said, I want to show you this person. And he describes the person, what he had been doing prior to his becoming a Vaishnav. So they're walking along the path leading to the little kutir. And Magari turns and looks, and he sees Narada Muni is coming with his friend Parvat Muni. So first thing he does is he gets up, and he wants to immediately run to the spiritual master and throw himself at the feet of the spiritual master, which is the thing that a dedicated, devoted, loving disciple likes to do, and ideally take the dust and rub it over his face. And so he starts a run, but he stops. He stops because he sees ants all over the place. He doesn't want to kill a single ant. This was a person who had no qualms, no doubts, no thought about not only killing an animal, but half killing it and causing it to be tormented and tortured. So he tiptoes here to there, to there, to there, and finally he throws himself at the feet of Narada Muni and offers, as I said, his obeisances, thanks him profusely for what he has given him. He's now a blissful, peaceful, happy, satisfied, fulfilled person. So this is the power, this is the impact that great sages have. So when we read these books and we read about these great sages, ideally, if we read about them with a sense of reverence, a sense of adoration, if we pray even to this book before we even start it, and thank Krishna for giving it to us, it is a great, great gift. I mean, books are books, but they're not books are books. Some books are so great, so grand, so wonderful, so glorious, they can take us right out of this material world and lift us, if we follow their instructions, the instructions of Krishna, right to the spiritual world and take us away from all the miseries, uncertainties, doubts, and anxieties, and troubles, and tribulations. So this book enables us, teaches us to develop pure love of God. This is what Magari did. Just by chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Va, or whatever he chanted. We know that Dhruva chanted Om. He wanted to be bigger than his grandfather, higher than him, Lord Brahma. He wanted to be so great that he could just boss anybody around. But the mantra, this is Narada Muni, tricked him. The mantra made him into a pure devotee of the Lord. And then he was seeing the Lord right in his heart. And he was ecstatic. He was blissful. He was so happy. And then suddenly the Lord appeared just outside him as he was appearing inside him, took his conch shell and kind of bopped him a little on the head. Like that. So Narada, he woke from his from his meditation, and there was the same Lord who he was seeing within. So it wasn't really a break in the meditation. It was just an extension of it. He was actually seeing the person. And all he could do was look at him with awe, with reverence, with such, he couldn't speak. He was tongue-tied. And he wanted to pray. And he was only a five-year-old boy. What kind of prayers, what kind of a vocabulary does a five-year-old boy? And yet he wanted to say the same kind of prayers that he would hear the Brahmins pray, you know, when he was at the kingdom. He wanted to give the Lord the highest adoration, the highest glorification. So the Lord, as I said, he touched him with the conch shell and gave him a vocabulary, gave him the understanding, gave him the intelligence, and he began to utter the most beautiful prayers, the best of which is, I was searching after just a bunch of glass, and by chanting this mantra of your name, I gained the greatest of jewels. And now I don't even care to go back to the kingdom. I don't want to be the best of the best of the best of the kings. I don't want to be better than Lord Brahma. I'm happy. I'm contented. Just let me be. So the Lord says, well, that may be your plan, but that's not my plan. He says, for 33,000 years, I want you back in the kingdom to set the example of what a great king is like. You now have character. You've got qualities. You've got virtues. You've got something that people will want to emulate. And not only that, but you're way above your brother Uttama. So he's not, definitely not going to be the next king. I mean, after what you have gone through, everybody knows you went to the forest alone, a little boy, not even caring, and he's going to find God. I mean, what little five-year-old boy goes out and does that? So he was worthy of getting the kingdom, becoming the king. And that's exactly what happened, of course. And not only that, but at the end of these, I think it was 33,000 years, he rules the kingdom very exemplarily, and a chariot comes from the spiritual world to take him there. Interestingly, as he's before he gets on the chariot, death personified steps in front of him. That's symbolic of Maya wanting to keep you back into the material world. Death, because life and death is basically the material world. Spiritual world is no life and death. It's eternal. It's everlasting. It's forever. So death is there. So Dhruva simply stepped on his head. You can't keep me back. I've been yearning. I've been praying. I've been desiring this for 33,000 years. And you're not going to hold me back. So he stepped on his head and entered. And then just before he entered the airplane, he looked around. Where's my mother? She was the one, Suniti. Suniti? Yeah. Suniti, where's my mother? She's the one who got me going on this. She said that if I want to achieve anything of greatness, then I have to approach the Supreme Lord. So I want her coming. So they said, but there's another airplane over there. Your mother's getting on it. Ah, okay, we'll go together. So this shows you the compassion, the appreciation, the gratitude that Dhruva. He wasn't just going there for himself. He actually, the way he ruled in such a noble and virtuous way, he wanted his entire kingdom to go back home, back to Godhead. That is the nature of a great king. He sees all of his subjects as his children and wants the very best for them, relieving them of difficulties and giving them gifts of spiritual blessing through sacrifices that he himself does. Is it time to end this now? Yeah? I mean, is this the end time, usual? Okay. So, I'll sum this up simply by saying that it is very important to recognize and remember the greatness of these books. I don't always do this, but I tell it in my classes to remind myself. To always, before I even open up the Bhagavatam, this is a gift from God. It's a gift from Krishna. As I said, it's not just a book. And we're very fortunate to have these books and to have a BBT who's printing these books and enabling us to read them and internalize them. By doing that, by praying to Krishna and thanking Krishna for the bounty, the grace to have this, we gain Krishna's grace. He says, this person is showing genuine and true appreciation. He's not just reading the book. He's reading it with the sense of that this is something precious. This is something glorious. This is something great. This is something grand. This is something not to be taken for granted. So, therefore, let me grace him. Let me give him, her, more blessings than I might normally. Blessings are always coming. But they come in different degrees. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path. So to the degree that we surrender, that's a form of surrender. My dear Lord, you are none different from this book, and I surrender unto you and beg that you, open my blind eyes so that I am able to understand it in such a way that I will want to serve you more, serve you better, and go on serving you forever. This is my desire. This is my goal. This is my wish. And if you do this, not only will I be happy, but the happiness that I will have will be a pure spiritual happiness. And the nature of spiritual happiness is that it doesn't hold itself, or it doesn't hog itself for itself, but it shares itself. That is the nature of it. Srila Prabhupada traveled, I think, 17 times around the world. Why? To share these teachings. Because the nature of pure love is it shares. It gives itself. It wants to please Krishna, knowing full well that Krishna is, if one thing bothers Krishna, it's the misery of all of his children. And Prabhupada knew for sure that these books could relieve that misery. Not only relieve it, but transform persons so that they could actually reach a higher and higher state of transcendental bliss, transcendental peace, transcendental love, transcendental knowledge. And if they had that, then their purpose in human life would truly and justly be fulfilled. And unless people have that, they have wasted their lives, and all that will come from that is more and more waste. People are traveling up the scale and down the scale of the material world, but never getting beyond it. And the result of that is endless cycle of birth, death, rebirth, all calculated to bring misery, tribulation, and difficulties, anxieties, no happiness. We can see there are endless medications people anxiety, people have to take for depression, people take all these different things. But once a person becomes truly Krishna conscious, and there are different levels and degrees of it, okay? So, but as we become more and more Krishna conscious, the result is that we're joyful, we're peaceful, we're strong, because we are in touch with the source. You know, we're all rays, remember I said at the beginning? So when the ray begins to look up to the source and begin to depend upon the source, and it begins to receive the grace of the source, then it becomes a manifestation of the source. The qualities of Krishna become our qualities in lesser or finite degree. And the result of that is that we are always happy and become even more happy when we see other people gaining transcendental happiness. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Ki. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments that any of you would care to make? I welcome them. But I don't welcome any comments which are of a political nature, controversial nature. I don't deal with that. We deal only with Krishna, pure love of Krishna, love of God. This is a temple for glorification of God. And I'll talk about any aspect of that, but not whether, he's a Ritvik and he comes to this temple and all these kind of things. It's not for here, for now. Okay? Not that I can't talk about, but not here, not now. Okay? No comments? No questions? Okay. Again, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. I'm sorry I missed it Sunday, but I was taken terribly ill. About 80% of my left lung was paralyzed, and I thought my ribs were bursting out of their skin, etc., etc. I couldn't hardly speak, but Krishna did a little miracle, and I was able to recover. So, again, all glories to Srila Prabhupada Ki. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Hare Krishna.